This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey everybody, I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Thanks again for everybody joining us today. I have a guest on the podcast, Dr. Chris Putnam. Welcome. Hello. And thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely great to be here, Noah. This is all brand new to me, so I am excited to be involved in this topic and this podcast itself. So I am all yours. You can ask any question.
Fantastic. Well, I do want to dive into what was a major decision of yours to get an advanced degree. But before we even go down that road, you know, why don't you just let everybody know your optometric history, you know, where you started and where you ended up and where you are now.
Oh, absolutely. I think for me to round out and give a more robust, more complete answer, I would go all the way back to high school for me. So I went to a very small high school in Minnesota. My graduating class was 28 kids in total. My mom was my chemistry teacher, my A&P teacher, my civics teacher, and my biology teacher. So
that's awesome.
When I chose to go to undergrad, I attended South Dakota State. And at that point, I really didn't stand a chance. I was a chemistry major out of sheer necessity and the fact that that's all I knew going into undergrad. So being a chemistry major, it was really more of that pre-professional background. So in undergrad, I think like most current optometrists, you take classes with everybody, pre-med, pre-dental, pre-nursing, pre-optometric, pre-mortuary, in fact. So I think that experience really kind of shaped why I leaned towards the optometric profession. And being from South Dakota State in the Midwest, interestingly, the optometric school of choice was Pacific University out in Portland, Oregon. And it had a lot to do with a Western Interstate scholarship. I believe it was a Witchy scholarship. And the intent was if you attended Pacific University, you would return to your home state, practice for 2 to 3 years. In return, they would pay for part of your optometric education. I was so excited to be part of the optometric profession when I applied to Pacific. I was so excited to get in that I didn't look closely at the details of it. Unfortunately, Minnesota was not part of that. So like a fool, I dove in head first and didn't even check the depth of the pool. But that notwithstanding, while I was in school, I figured out the lack of scholarship really was something that I wanted to rectify. So during your first year, the armed forces will send recruiters from each branch, whether that be Army, Air Force, Navy. I talked to all three branches, really got a good sense from what the Air Force mission was at that point, what the role of an optometrist was in a flying mission, an operational sense. So during my optometric school in my second year, I took a health profession scholarship to essentially attend the Air Force and join the Air Force post-graduation. And what it was a two-year scholarship for a three-year commitment. And so after graduation in 2005, I went to officer training down in Alabama, spent 6 weeks down there learning customs and courtesies and just crossing into the blue, as they say. And then my first assignment was at Lackland Air Force Base. So at Lackland Air Force Base, it was really very just fortuitous. It was kismet almost that Lackland Air Force Base was also at the time the home of the United States Air Force residency. So you had to pay back your 3-year commitment before you could apply. But during my third year of service in the United States Air Force, I applied to the Air Force residency, and the optometric residency in the Air Force was much like an ocular disease residency, because at Lackland Air Force Base was Wilford Hall Medical Center, and that was the training site of all Air Force ophthalmology at that time. So as an Air Force optometry resident, you essentially work directly with the first year ophthalmology residents. And really your role was to teach them the basics, because a lot of the first year ophthalmology residents are just tossed into the deep end. They are shown a video on how to do retinoscopy, how to use a slit lamp, and how to use a BIO. And then they're told, hey, on Monday, you'll be seeing walk-in patients at 0700. And thinking back to our optometric careers, I'm sure there's some sheer looks of panic in the eyes, because if you've never seen a patient in that setting and you are unfamiliar with the equipment you're being asked to use, how in the world are you expected to provide good high-level care? So optometry's role was really just to kind of get the ophthalmology residents comfortable with some of the basic skills of an optometric exam and an ophthalmological exam. And then from there, I really got interested in some of the transitional research that the ophthalmology third years and some of the attendings were involved in. And what I mean by that is they were looking at existing devices, maybe a prototype or a breadboard level device. And what they were trying to do was, the theory was proven, there was some value in what they could bring, but a commercial device didn't exist, or there wasn't a technique that had been refined or gained, say, FDA approval, or even been picked up for any NIH or NEI study. So I was very intrigued that there are a lot of good ideas just ruminating out there, but it was very difficult to cross that chasm. And we'll talk more about it in a moment. But when I did my graduate training, it was always considered the chasm of concern, or the valley of death. And what that was is, you'd have this incredible basic science concept. You would have this incredible just phenomenology that you could kind of help explain. You understood why something worked the way it did. You would build it up to almost a prototype. But to make it go from prototype to something viable and commercially available, you had to get somebody else that had a deep pocket to buy in to fund that transition. And so many things withered on the vine because there was no champion to pull it across that chasm. There was no driver to get across that chasm. And a lot of great ideas really sat there until someone was willing to pluck them, bring them across, and find someone to help with the funding. And so that's a very long-winded a review of getting me to the point where I graduated from the residency. I was very excited about being a clinician, but I always had that idea in the back of my head that, what about all these other great ideas? Because that was a small snapshot at a very single base within the Air Force. What about the rest of the Air Force? What about the rest of the DOD? And lo and behold, when I was then transferred to my next assignment at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, there was an offer or a call for what is called the AFIT, or Air Force Institute of Technology, for PhD students that would like to seek training through a civilian institution, but the Air Force would fund you. And so 42Es, which is the specialty code for optometrists in the Air Force, they were specifically looking for optometrists that would go do a three-year accelerated PhD at a civilian institution, and in return, we would give them 5 years working within our Air Force research labs, or specifically the human performance wing. And to me, that was too good a deal to pass up. So from there, I took that opportunity, spent 3 years at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, worked under a Dr. Carl Bassey, who had trained at the Doheny Eye Institute. He was a USC guy, did some of his work at Vanderbilt in undergrad. And interestingly, he was a psychology background. So a lot of his training was in psychophysical work. A lot of his training was in kind of the methodology and the understanding of how stimulus passes through the visual pathway and becomes either a sensory reaction or a motor function. And so I was very, very fortunate to be paired up with someone who, from an optometric standpoint, a lot of what we do is psychophysiology, and a lot of what we do is psychophysics. You know, the entire manifest refractive sequence is psychophysics. So I think there's a lot of value in finding Dr. Bassey there at the University of Missouri. And really after that, I found myself back in the Air Force Research Labs. And now here I am in San Antonio, Texas, working at the basic training, essentially gateway to the Air Force. And then I have tie-ins to the 7-Eleven Human Performance Wing, where we do directed energy bioeffects research, retinal injury recognition research, and how to do protection versus performance in an operational environment.
Fantastic, Chris. All right, I want to dive in a little bit deeper to some of the things that you walked us through. I do really appreciate that. The first thing that actually makes me laugh a bit is you are well aware that my wife is also an optometrist from Minnesota, and she actually had 17 people in her graduating high school class, and I think she was related to three of them. So something about maybe that'd be a future podcast, you know, absolutely, going to school in Minnesota. All right. So the first thing that caught my attention, you know, even though it's not yet to the topic of the advanced degree, is your decision to do the Air Force optometric residency was a bit different than what a lot of our current residents have to make, or when their decision comes into play. There is certainly a number of folks that enter their optometric career and then decide later to go do a residency, but more often than not, it's students in their fourth year of optometry school making this first career decision. And I've actually had a podcast, one already, about that. What led you, you know, specifically, was it just a thirst for knowledge? Was it, well, I just happen to be in Lackland anyway, I may as well go for it. You know, would you think you would have done the residency had you not been in the Air Force and you just went into optometric practice for 2 or 3 years? You know, how did this come all to fruition for you in terms of making this decision?
Absolutely. And that's a fantastic question. I really think that had I not joined the Air Force and had I not been assigned to Lackland Air Force Base, which had the training ground for the Air Force ophthalmology program at the time, I really don't know if I had done or would have done the residency. And it's not that I didn't have a thirst for knowledge or wouldn't have wanted to pursue it, but I think even speaking from the standpoint of a lot of my classmates, once you graduate optometry school, you know, you're kind of on this path that, hey, now I need to find a job, start a family, buy a home, and you get, life gets in the way, for lack of a better expression, that it's not that you wouldn't have done that, but now suddenly you have a, you know, a child on the way, or you've bought a home, or you've bought a practice, or you'd like to settle down. And, you know, for many optometry students, you've just done 4 years of undergrad, and now you've just completed 4 years of optometry school, and now you're kind of ready to make your life your own again. And a residency, for all of its incredible opportunities and the doors it can open, requires you to yet again compete, essentially find a match and go somewhere else in the country and work for someone else for not as much as you would make if you were to, say, go open the doors of your own practice or work commercially for a while or join a university as a faculty or a clinical member. So I would say that I was very lucky to be in a position to have those 3 years to kind of figure things out. And I would say at the end of the 3 years, my desire to do the residency was absolutely peaked, because there were so many cases where I would see and have a vague understanding and notion of what the management techniques were, what the diagnostic techniques were, what the differentials were, and then what the ultimate, you know, treatment and management would be. But I remember being a little bit envious, because sometimes you would speak to the second and the third year ophthalmology residents who have had hundreds of cases, and you've maybe seen three or four. And it all came down to volume for me. And sure, so that is the one thing that the residency really provided to me that I tell everyone that ever asks, it's all about the number of patients. If you can work in a disease setting where virtually every single patient of yours has either a systemic disease with an ophthalmic manifestation or has an ophthalmic disease at an advanced state, you are going to get very, very good at the easy stuff, because every single patient of yours is complex. And so I think that is what the optometric residency added to me, that had I not done that, I think there would always be a piece missing from where I'm at today.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. I think that was very, very well stated, and a huge take home for what I mentioned before, what for a lot of people is one of the first crossroads decisions in their optometric career. All right, so you mentioned that while you were at Scott Air Force Base, the alert came across to you in some way, shape, or form that there was a opportunity to go on for a DOD Air Force funded PhD. Was it only a PhD option, or was there a master's degree option, or both?
At the current time, it was only a PhD option. I had heard later through the grapevine that a few years prior, there was a MS in vision science option, but that had no longer been been offered to us. And the rationale was, is the PhD allowed us to be our own independent investigators, meaning when you do your graduate training and when you go through and do your experimental design and some of your biostatistical analyses, you essentially gain a little bit more insight in how to write an NIH grant. You gain a little bit more insight in how to actually develop a rigorous, well-designed study that has robust results that can meet statistical significance. And I think the rationale from the Air Force's standpoint was they wanted someone at the PhD level that just had an extra year, maybe an extra 18 months to spend going through those paces and writing a grant and doing a full dissertation that prepares you for what is needed when you write a project for program approval, or if you are writing a grant proposal, no matter who the funding authority is, they want someone who has gone through that, written a couple grants, and got comfortable with it. A master's student is absolutely capable of that, but because their timeline is a little bit shorter than the PhD route, they don't have as much experience. And I think that almost ties right back into the residency route. It's not that a talented, ambitious fourth-year student couldn't do exactly what a resident could do. It simply just means that that resident had an extra year to see more things, have a higher volume of patients, and get a little bit more comfortable with the things they're going to do on a daily basis. So that's why the PhD was the only pathway offered at that time.
Got it. So did the Air Force decide the topic focus of the PhD program, was whether it be vision science or physiological optics, or did you have an opportunity to have a voice in that decision at all?
Yeah, and interestingly, that was the best thing about it being a civilian institution program. The fact was that the Air Force said that they want you to go to that institution. You will now be affiliated with the Air Force Institute of Technology. And you are a program manager, but they don't have any say in your curriculum. They don't have any say in what your academic focus is, because you are now a PhD student under that university. And so when you work with your graduate advisor or your mentor or even your graduate committee, when that selection process comes, you are free to pursue whatever you want. I was very lucky that I did have some mentorship in the Air Force at the time, and they did give some very good guidance that, all of that being true, you are welcome to pursue any course of study, any emphasis of research you would like, but there's a lot of value in finding out where you may be assigned afterwards or what programs are currently being funded in the Air Force for an operational standpoint, and find out what projects or what your area of emphasis, how it could tie into one of those existing projects. So although you're free to seek anything you want, it was just a lot easier to find your niche, I guess, and essentially lend your research to an ongoing project. So that way, the moment you show up after graduation, after dissertation defense, you slide in neatly and already have a carved out piece of what you will be doing within the Air Force Research Laboratory.
Got it. All right. So now I really want to hear how you felt at this time in the process. I guess, first off, how did you pick the school? Did you have to take the GRE? Were there any other prerequisites you needed, or did you just submit an application? And was it intimidating that this program had to be done in 3 years, or do you think that that's actually the average timeline, or was it accelerated? As I think you mentioned that word earlier before. And then, I know you're a doctor at this point. You're a clinician. You finish your residency, but what's the intimidation factor and the unknowns in now diving into an advanced degree realm?
So let's see if I can parse that out a little bit. So I would say first thing is you're absolutely right. When you apply to the AFIT program, there are some prerequisites. The GRE is a prerequisite. And the interesting thing is that you had to meet GRE requirements for not only the AFIT acceptance and competitive pool and selection process, but you also had to meet GRE requirements for the university you were seeking acceptance to. So those were two different things. You might be accepted by AFIT, but if you don't meet the requirements for entry to the university, you can't go to that university. So I have had a number of individuals who I've worked with, because after graduation, I became the PLC for our graduate program. So not only are TBI and neuro rehab VA residency, but also our essentially sports vision fellowship that we have recently stood up, but also the PhD program in vision science. And so some of the students that have followed behind me, I've emphasized to them that you can't lose sight that you are still an Air Force officer and still need to meet Air Force requirements, but the university is where you are going to live and work, and you need to meet their requirements, because ultimately the conferral of the degree is dependent on the university. The acceptance of your proposal is contingent on the university, and your dissertation defense and acceptance is on the university. And without those, you go nowhere. And you mentioned the intimidation factor. At this point, I had been out of school. I began my PhD program in 2011. I hadn't, you know, really, I guess, hit the books for about 6 to 7 years at that point. So I would say that the advantage of doing the PhD in vision science is virtually every optometrist, I would say every optometrist out there, you've seen a lot of the graduate work. You know, when you think of the A&P portions, if you think of some of the vision information processing, some of the psychophysics, some of just the basic neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, we've all gone through that. In fact, I would say optometrists are well suited to do an accelerated program because you have a lot of those courses under your belt. The only thing that gets a little bit different is the PhD program does ask you to involve yourself with students of different disciplines. So a lot of my courses were with neuroscience graduate students, psychology, whether that be industrial organizational, whether that be clinical psychology students, and then physics students. So in fact, it was very intimidating to have these different, genres, these different areas of emphasis are all around you, because they sounded incredibly brilliant in their own different areas. But that was the value and the wisdom of crowds, because they looked at problems differently than I looked at problems, and I looked at problems differently than they did. So when we would do group projects, or when we would do some of our, you know, biologic basis of behavior and some of our advanced biostats, they would just look at things differently than I, and we would get a more robust answer, actually maybe a little bit better experience, because we worked together and saw how everybody else thinks. So the intimidation, although there at first, wears off if you are a driven, motivated student.
So once you dove in and now you're biting off quite a bit, how did you identify who your supervisor was? And was it a process that you, you know, looked at a bunch of different professors? Did you meet with a bunch? Did you look at their, you know, their prior research and or look at their personalities? You know, what's the process of you identifying who's going to be your main point of contact through the PhD and really guide you through your research thesis, et cetera?
And I would say that the number one thing is it needs to be a an individual and a personality that you can work well with. And I know that might sound a bit counterintuitive, because at first blush, you might think, well, I want to have someone whose interests align with mine, or I would like to study with someone who has a background or an experience level and something I would love to become an expert in. But I've seen it several times in the past. If you don't have a mentor, if your graduate advisor, your primary graduate advisor, does not have a personality that meshes well with yours, or doesn't understand that you have 3 years to take care of everything in a timeline that in some cases takes 4 or 5 years for a traditional PhD student, you are fighting an uphill battle. I mean, you are a Sisyphus pushing that boulder up the hill, because that advisor, although they are your mentor from an academic and an intellectual standpoint, there are some times that during that graduate process, you're kind of on your own. The autonomy is so very high that in optometry school, you're all taking an exam on Friday, right? You've all got clinical checkouts on Tuesday. You all are in this together, and there is some solidarity and comfort in knowing you're all in this together. But in the graduate program, there was essentially 6 of us in the program, but we were all at different stages, and all of our projects were disparate enough that we might take classes together, but once the classes are over, we're on our own, and there is no one holding your feet to the fire. The autonomy is so high that you could walk out the door and come back a week later, and you're not getting docked for attendance, you're not getting an F, you're just not going to complete your project, which you, if you lose lock, if you lose sight of that, it's very easy to get so far behind you can't recover. So your graduate advisor needs to be there to kind of nudge you along if you lose lock, or make sure that you don't get, you know, distracted by something shiny. And I make that joke because I got distracted by shiny things all the time. We had a number of small projects that were not integral to my dissertation topic, but they were so intriguing to me. So we did some temporal resolution tasks. We did some additional kind of spatial versus temporal timed identification and accuracy tests. And we did a bunch of other small projects that we ended up publishing and getting some good recognition for, but they had nothing to do with my dissertation. But I spent a lot of time and energy because I was just excited about it. And so every once in a while, he'd have to just pull me back in, kind of like that Spike and Chester cartoon. You know, I was so excited to be involved in any of these things, but he had to really just make sure that don't lose focus. You've got 3 years, you've got these milestones, and these milestones are the only thing that you cannot miss. So personality match and having an advisor that cares and is invested in your success, that is critical to the success.
You know, based on the people that you work with, what do you think the average person takes time-wise to complete, to start and then complete a PhD?
I think if you went in cold without an optometry background, I could see 4 to 5 years. And that is not necessarily because they're poor students. It's because from a graduate standpoint, you're allowed to CLEP out of most of the courses. You are allowed to take a written exam for some of your geometric, physiologic optics, physical optics. You can essentially show mastery or understanding. So you don't have to take the, say, let's call them 100, 200 level courses all over again. I would say if you went in as a bachelor's entering for an advanced degree, it's going to be 4 to 5 years. If you enter as an OD seeking a PhD, I think 3 years is very reasonable, but you can't slack. There is not time to, you know, just join a think tank and wax philosophically about you know, esoteric ideas. You need to keep your nose at the grindstone and make sure that everything you do each day has some value and is committed to the ultimate success of you having a defense proposal be accepted. And then ultimately getting your device built, your paradigm built, your essentially methodology solid, that when it comes to defense proposal time and you submit that first draft, that every day you're gotten a little bit more written, you've gotten a little bit more feedback, you've gotten a little closer to that end game of a successful defense proposal.
So walk us, you know, just give us a brief overview or snapshot of what exactly your dissertation and research was focused on. And then next, you know, what has it prepared you to do right now? And what do you think is next for you?
So my dissertation defense was titled The Spatial Mapping of Macular Pigment Optical Density and Its Relationship with Contrast Sensitivity, Glare Disability, and Photostress Recovery. It's a big mouthful. So what we really were looking at was the macular pigment, which is essentially, it's constituted by lutein, zeaxanthin, and mesozeaxanthin, so the xanthophyllic carotenoids that are deposited within the photoreceptor axons. So the photoreceptor axons, primarily Henle fiber layer, they have macular pigment that are specifically deposited at levels 1,000 times higher than serum. So I was always intrigued that from just a purely ecological standpoint, why in the world are all of these macular pigments in the retina, and why are they 1,000 times higher concentration than serum? I mean, there has to be a reason for that. And so I think in school, you talk about the macular pigment, you might even note it in a chart or two, you might even say, hey, it looks like they've got a very prominent macular pigment spot, but you don't really, I think, you're not fully initiated into what that macular pigment can do from not only an optical standpoint, but a neural processing standpoint, and ultimately a protection against a lot of inflammatory and oxidative stress disease. So what my project was to use a heterochromatic flicker photometer and spatially map it across the entire macula. So we did a psychophysical technique that allowed me to map out spatial differences amongst a healthy population and look for difference in their contrast sensitivity at that location, look at a difference in their glare disability or their ability to recover from a bright light. And we found that like much of the literature had suggested up to that point, that it was not only critical centrally, but what my dissertation showed, that even if that exponential decay from a very sharp peak of macular pigment right at the foveola, even as it decays and gets much less optical density with an eccentricity, that eccentricity, that optical density still matters when you're talking about a glare disability or a photostress recovery. So What we did was my advisor always mentioned that from a science or research standpoint, you take that, there's a sphere of knowledge, and your job as a PhD student is to create a tiny little nub, the smallest little poke outward in that sphere, because you're not going to add to the giant sphere itself, but there's a tiny little, you know, tiny little wedge that you're going to add. And if you can put anything inside that existing sphere of knowledge, you've done something well. So, my dissertation kind of wrapped up again in about 3 years. Very fortunate we published a couple articles along the way. Did have some good success in presenting some of my articles and essentially bringing some of that to my new lab. And then from the standpoint of what my spatial mapping, what our research findings concluded and brought to the table is when I joined the Air Force Research Laboratory and specifically the 711 Human Performance Wing, we had a group that was already working on macular pigment. So Dr. James Stringham, Dr. Leon Macklin were already at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio working on low light levels and the mesopic improvements of higher macular pigment. And so we kind of use a lot of my data, some of my techniques, and pushed it in. And what we're finding is you can extend essentially the mesopic sensitivity with higher levels of macular pigment, meaning that if I'm trying to accentuate cone function and photopic response, a little higher resolution, a little quicker reaction. If I have a higher macular pigment, I can make you see a little bit better at those low light levels. And the military likes to do its operations in low light levels. So there was a lot of value in bringing some of what we had already done at University of Missouri and putting it into the existing architecture. And so from there, we started looking a little bit more closely at what macular pigment can do from a protection standpoint. So if it's a visible laser dazzle, or if it is a protection against a non-visible laser, there was some early work that we started looking at of what you can do to either mitigate or potentially provide some protection against low energy, low injury laser exposure. So that's really where we're at with that now.
Fascinating. Yeah, really is special. And so what do you think is next for you?
To be honest with you, the Air Force has taken it upon themselves to send me to Saudi Arabia. So I am actually going to Qatar here in about 4 weeks, and I will be assuming squadron command of a medical operations squadron. So I think that, interestingly, the PhD and the opportunity to spend some time in a lab where, as you spend your second and third year, there are new students that come up behind you, and you will have a responsibility for not only teaching labs at the optometry student level, but you also are then working as kind of a graduate advisor, graduate assistant for some of the new students. And I think it kind of honed my skills from a leadership standpoint, that you knew how important a good mentor was. So in an effort to pay it forward, I wanted to be the best mentor. And I just kind of took that in and made that part of what I strive to do each and every day for not only the students, but say the airmen around me. And so from that standpoint, I was fortunate enough to get selected. So I will go to Qatar for a year, spend some time doing my best as a medical operations commander. And then when I come back, ultimately, I would like to return to academia. I found the 3 years as a PhD student at the University of Missouri, some of the best professional years of my life. I love working with students. We have an externship program at Joint Base San Antonio in Lackland now. And I love working with the students, because just that opportunity to find a student who is maybe on the verge or doesn't know what they want to do next. I knew how important it was to see a preceptor or a faculty member who was excited, who was energetic, who seemed to love what they do. And that made me love what I did. And so, I think what is next, hopefully, is a faculty position at a university somewhere out there. So if there's anyone listening, I am very, very excited to submit a CV or even talk about my research if you think there's an opportunity to work at a university.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to work with you someday, Chris. So when the Air Force calls it quits, you just give me a buzz.
You got it.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to a lot of what you said. I don't know exactly the year, but I'll talk in a future podcast. I think I'd probably been out somewhere between 7 and 10 years when I decided to do a master's degree in healthcare administration and had not been in the classroom and really had a full-time job while I was taking that on. And I think it was 20 years into practice when I decided to do a PhD program, of which I'm probably now months away from completing, thank goodness. And so I guess where I want you to wrap us up is, you know, you took on the residency, you took on the PhD program, you've taken on a ton of research, you know, as a colleague in optometry, who can do this? Is this only something that the brightest people in optometry can do? You know, is this somebody who's just willing to work hard and roll up their sleeves can do? You know, if there's anybody that's just concerned, wow, can I really do this? What would you say?
I would say that I am living proof that you do not need to be special to be a PhD. And so that is not meant to denigrate or essentially undermine the struggles, the intellectual ferocity that it takes to complete a PhD program. But I think that you hit the nail on the head that a good graduate student, I think the best graduate students are tenacious. The best graduate students are the ones that have a hunger to figure out why something works and can something else work better. If you are diligent, you are willing to spend time and do the things that, for lack of a better term, that aren't sexy, meaning you're going to spend a lot of time as a graduate student. And Chris, I'm sure you know this. There's a lot of times where there's no accolades for you. You are studying by yourself. It's the middle of the night. There are no cheering crowds. There is no one watching what you're doing, but you are doing what you do because, first of all, you refuse to fail. You will complete this program, and you want to be better tomorrow than you were the day before. So any advice I would give to a burgeoning graduate student or advanced degree program is, if you've gone to optometry school, you can absolutely do a PhD without question. I would even write a letter of recommendation for you. I think the biggest thing is just knowing that when you get into it, it will take a lot of autonomy. It will take a lot of kind of just stubborn, refuse to quit. But if you want it, you can achieve it. And I truly think that if you've completed optometry school, you've been through it. You know what it takes to be a successful student. And I think that professional program can translate nicely into a graduate program. So yes, I am living proof that if you want a PhD and you have the opportunity to pursue it, you too can achieve that PhD status.
I love it. My favorite word for going through all this is perseverance.
Absolutely.
Day in, day out, perseverance.
Absolutely right. Yeah, resiliency, because that's the other thing is there are going to be some days where it wasn't better than the day before. Where everything's broken, your methods. So I use site kinematics on a Mac. I'm not a Mac guy. I could not code. I didn't have a background in coding. I had to learn MATLAB. There were days where I was there very late, and I'm not ashamed to admit it now. I mean, I was cracking a little bit. I'm like yelling at the ceiling. I'm angry at everything. I'm not a coder. But if you persevere, if you have resiliency and you refuse to quit, you can absolutely achieve your graduate goals.
Fantastic. I love it, Chris. I love that you spent some time with us. It's been a really phenomenal career of yours so far. Very impressive. And I definitely love to have you on again.
Oh, absolutely. If you choose a topic, I can go on and on. So I'm more than happy to join you again. I am very honored to be asked in the first place. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Great. All right. Thank you, Chris.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.